Tonight, the Chris and Rob Late Night Talk Show in association with Stepchild Radio, WAIF-FM in Cincinnati, Ohio, is proud to present you another edition of UFO Update. UFO Update is a show that we present from time to time. You may have seen the cable access version on channel
10 or 7.
Channel 10 or 7. UFO Update presents you the hottest breaking news in the world of UFO sightings, abductions, and other paranormal phenomena. And tonight, our guest in the studio is Mr. Terry Endress of the Anomaly Research Center and the Center for UFO Studies. First of all, what in the world is the Anomaly Research Center?
Well, it's a group of independent researchers who try to bring some common sense to the rather perplexing field of anomaly research.
What's an anomaly? I thought an anomaly was something that grew on the side of a boat in the ocean.
No, not quite. That's an anomaly. Or something like that. But no, an anomaly is a phenomena which seems to defy prosaic explanation. And that's what we really try to do, is try to find a prosaic explanation to fit the anomaly.
For example, an unidentified flying saucer would be an anomaly. Absolutely. Because we don't know what it is.
Exactly.
You're also affiliated somehow with the Center for UFO Studies.
That's correct.
I imagine that's a locally based organization.
No, that's out of Chicago.
Oh,
it's
really?
Actually the J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies, named after J. Allen Hynek, who was, of course, for 20 years, the Air Force's consultant on UFOs. He was an astronomer. And he founded in 1972, I believe it was, the Center for UFO Studies, so that real science could be done with UFO sightings.
We're also joined on the telephone by Peter Davenport. Hello, Mr. Davenport.
Good evening.
You can hear us all right and everything?
I can hear you fine.
You answer the phones at the UFO Reporting Hotline. Now, what exactly is the UFO Reporting Hotline?
Well, it is a telephone, essentially a telephone number where people may call if they believe that they have seen something that is anomalous, something that may be a UFO. The National UFO Reporting Center was founded about 24 years ago in Seattle in response to a fairly major flap of UFO sightings across the United States in October of 1973. In fact, some of those very dramatic sightings occurred in your state there in Ohio.
Zanesville, right?
Yes. There were several sightings over your state. Quite a dramatic incident with a military helicopter that bumped into something during a flight to Columbus, I believe it was.
Now, wait a minute. If a helicopter is going to bump into something, unless it's a bird or a bat, it's probably going to crash.
I'm speaking facetiously here. Okay. It didn't literally bump into it. It encountered something in the atmosphere over Ohio. But the UFO Reporting Center was set up by Mr. Bob Gribble, quite a well-known UFO investigator here in the Northwest, in response to that flap and to others, and it's been operating 24 hours a day ever since.
Before we get into what's currently being reported around the country, first let me ask you, Mr. Davenport, how did you get involved in the UFO Reporting Hotline and the Center for UFO Studies, and what have you found over the years? Do you think that there is a UFO phenomena, something that's physically coming either from another dimension or maybe even outer space?
Yeah, there are a couple questions there. First of all, although I hold the work of the Center for UFO Studies in very high regard, I technically am not a member of that organization. I am the director of the National UFO Reporting Center based in Seattle. Some of the recent sightings have been very dramatic. The one that comes to mind immediately was an event that we're quite sure occurred over the western half of the state of Washington on the 22nd of April this year, Wednesday night. We have very strong evidence in the form of about two dozen reports now that a disc-shaped object, estimated by at least one observer to have been about 60 feet in diameter, covered about 500 miles in a big, long, sweeping turn above the state of Washington. And it covered roughly 500 miles. We estimate, certainly in under 8 minutes, it might have been more like 5 minutes. We're not sure. But that was a very dramatic sighting, and what makes it particularly interesting is that that object was seen to slow and descend over the Bangor submarine base out just about 30 miles west of Seattle, and it passed right over the cement underground bunkers that are thought to house nuclear weapons.
Wow. How many people saw this anomaly?
Well, we received about 24 reports. Probably many hundreds or perhaps thousands of people were witness to the display in the aerial or in the sky of this object. The people who saw it close to the ground are relatively few, according to the people who have talked to us, or I should say we've received relatively few reports from people who saw it close to the ground, but enough to get a very good description of the object.
You know, if a couple of people or three or four people call in a report, maybe it was a crank or maybe they were seeing something that was explainable. But when that many people, several dozen or more, call in and report the same type of object, you take it a little more seriously?
Well, I think that's the case. It is what I would call a self-corroborating case in the sense that we took a number of calls in very rapid sequence shortly after the incident from seemingly credible people, none of whom appeared to know about other people's reports. So the reports are independent as far as we can tell. Moreover, some of the people who reported to us are extremely skilled people, very professional, many of them never having seen what they thought was a UFO in their lives until this incident. And that tends to shore up the believability of their reports, I feel.
Yeah, Peter,
yeah.
Are there any videotapes or photos or even any kind of radar confirmation from area airports?
No radar confirmation that I'm aware of. There was a report of video. One of the local television stations here, an ABC affiliate, attempted to get the video. But when they pursued it, the individual wanted too much money for it, they said. And when we pursued it, the individual said that the tape had been taped over, allegedly.
Ouch.
So we don't know the full story on that tape.
You're tuned into the UFO Update, brought to you by the Chris and Rob Late Night Talk Show and WAIF. I'm Chris Comer, and Terry Endress with the Anomaly Research Center is sitting to my right. And we're talking to Peter Davenport from Seattle, Washington. He's in charge of the National UFO Reporting Center, and he's telling us everything that's hot and heavy in the UFO world right now. Can we take some calls? Is it all right with you, Peter?
Oh, I'd welcome it.
If anyone would like to call in and talk to myself, Terry, or Peter Davenport, the phone number to call in would be 961-8900. Peter, this doesn't mean we'll get a call, but we'll do
okay.
Our best. 961-8900. What were you going to say, Pete?
I was just going to say, if you think your listeners would enjoy it, I would like to play about a 60-second audio cut of the report we took over the telephone from the gentleman who saw this disc pass directly over, allegedly over Bangor Submarine Base. I think it would give our listeners some feeling for the quality of report we took on this case.
Go right ahead. It'll sound good over the phone lines, I imagine.
I will give it a try and see what happens.
You've done this on national radio before, haven't you?
Pardon?
You've done this on national radio before, haven't you?
I have done this a number of times.
That's what I thought.
It seems to have worked pretty well. This will be a test, and we'll see what happens.
Okay.
In any event, this is what was reported to us with regard to that incident on the 22nd of April, 1998, this year. Here we go.
Thank you.
Boy, I don't know what happened.
See, I knew there'd be a technical glitch. I knew there'd be.
And I live, about a half mile from the Bangor submarine base.
Mm-hmm.
I was looking out in a second floor bedroom window towards the base when I noticed a circular disc-shaped object approximately 3/4 mile from my house.
Mm-hmm.
It was also about 300 feet above the ground, about 200 feet above the tree line. The object appeared to be 50 to 60 feet long and was moving from a north to south direction towards the center of the Bangor submarine base.
Mm-hmm.
It was circular, but it was tilted at about, it seemed to be tilted at about a 35-degree angle with the bottom towards me.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that tilt, there was a slight oval shape to it.
Mm-hmm. And what did you see on the bottom of it?
The entire bottom of the craft was glowing with a white light. It wasn't a bright light that shone down to the ground. It was more just a very bright white glow.
Mm-hmm.
Except for the center section, there was a circular area in the center that comprised about 30% of the diameter of the disk, and that center section was black.
I don't know how you heard that.
Oh, it sounded great.
Well, but that was one of the many reports we took about that object, and if any of your listeners would like to see an illustration of that, they can go to our website and click on the top item, I believe it is, on our home page, and they will see that gentleman's illustration, which he generated with a computer, to show what he saw that night.
Yeah, it sounds like he paid a lot of attention to what he was looking at. In fact, just the sound of what he was saying, it sounded like he actually had written it down before he even bothered trying to talk about it.
That's right, Terry. That is exactly the case. This man is an engineer with decades of experience, never having seen a UFO before, and that's what he called it. He said it was one of the most unusual things he's ever seen in his life.
And your website, sir, is?
The website address is simply www.ufocenter.com.
Thanks for making it easy to remember.
You bet.
We're talking to Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. If you yourself have seen a UFO, do you want to give out the phone number on the radio?
Yeah, if it's been a recent sighting within the last 2 or 3 days, we would welcome a telephone call. If, however, it's been several days, weeks, or years in the past, we prefer to take the reports off our website. There's a standardized report form there that they can fill out with the date and a description of the incident. But our telephone number in Seattle is area code 206-722-3000.
Now, Peter, you say you've been at this for, well, almost a quarter century or so?
Well, the center's been here since 74. I became director, the second director, in July of 1994.
I see.
About 4 years ago.
But personally, your involvement in the field has stretched over how many years?
I saw my first UFO as a lad of 6 in 1954. My first article on the incident at Exeter in Exeter, New Hampshire,
right,
was August of 1965.
Mm-hmm.
And I have been captivated by the phenomenon ever since. Became a member of MUFON in 1991 and have done a great deal of reading and investigation informally of a number of sightings, probably since 65.
Over that time, is there a specific case or cases that come to mind that sort of help nail the lid down tight on this phenomenon
yeah.
for you?
There have been some very dramatic cases, which I'll touch on here in a second, but I would say that probably the most convincing aspect of my job is the sheer volume of reports, many of which turn out to be just pedestrian terrestrial objects,
mm-hmm.
aircraft, lights, and so on. But the volume of seemingly credible reports leaves no doubt in my mind worth mentioning but what the UFO phenomenon is very real, and we appear quite clearly to be dealing with craft or objects that are under intelligent control. However, to go to the first part of your question, Terry, in my opinion, the events that occurred over the state of Arizona on the 13th of March, 1997, the so-called Phoenix Lights, although many people are attempting to allege that, or do allege that they were caused by flares, that ignores the first hour of the events over Arizona. That, in my opinion, is a candidate for being the most dramatic UFO event that has occurred over the United States in the last 50 years.
Okay, well, in looking back on UFO history, though, there's often a problem with sightings that are seen for long duration by lots of people.
Yes.
Usually that does warrant some kind of prosaic explanation, because UFO sightings, not as a rule, but in general practice, seem to be fairly localized events. And I guess probably it's just the overwhelming area over which those sightings were seen that kind of leads one to speculate that something unusual is happening. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that we can altogether rule out flares. Of course, you know, as you say, that ignores the first hour or so of sightings. But it doesn't mean that, you know, there isn't a combination of things going on at the same time. Correct?
I'm not clear what you're leading to there, Terry. Some of your statements I agree with.
Right.
But a summary of that case, again from the 13th of March, 1997, shows that the object or objects, for example, passed through the airspace
mm-hmm.
of at least three international airports, perhaps as many as seven. It did not show up on radar. It did not communicate by radio. It hovered for an estimated 5 minutes, 1 mile south of Camelback Mountain
mm-hmm.
at an altitude thought to be, from what pilots reported they were looking at an altitude of 8,700 feet.
Mm-hmm.
It fired a momentary beam of light down at the ground, which we do not understand. It appeared capable of changing its shape, and it appears that it was capable of supersonic flight as well as being able to hover motionless in the night sky. That is not consistent with any aircraft that I am aware of.
So what is your feeling, obviously the feeling, but if you could put it in words, your reaction then to the Maryland Air National Guard's admission that they were flying some sort of maneuvers at that time? Where do you class that explanation?
Yeah, there are many possibilities. That may be an accurate report.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know. But they claim that they launched those flares after 9:30, perhaps even towards 10 o'clock. I'm not clear on exactly what they've said. I haven't talked to those people.
Right.
But the events earlier in the evening began at 6:55 p.m. over Henderson, Nevada.
Mm-hmm.
The object that I just described was seen over three states, Nevada, Arizona, and New Mexico. That's a little-known fact among many of the skeptics or obstructionists who would like to have Americans believe that nothing of consequence or interest happened that night over Arizona. That clearly is not the case. The object was first reported to us over the telephone at 7:22 p.m. It was approximately 80 miles north of Arizona, and of course the Barry Goldwater firing range at
mm-hmm.
Gila Bend is about a minimum of 62 miles to the southwest of Phoenix. So clearly what people were seeing to the north of Phoenix was not those alleged flares that allegedly were launched by A-10s over the firing range.
We're talking to Peter Davenport of the National UFO Reporting Center right here on UFO Update, brought to you by Chris and Rob and WAIF. If you'd like to call into the program and talk to one of our guests, the phone number is 961-8900. I'll repeat that. It's 961-8900. I'm Chris Comer. Terry Endress with the Anomaly Research Center is here. And Peter Davenport, I know now why, when you're on some of those nationally syndicated late-night programs, they keep you on for 5 hours. Because you got a lot to say, and you've been privy to a lot of UFO action over the years.
I guess I do have a lot to say.
Well, if you're the guy, you know, if you're the guy answering the phone at the UFO reporting hotline, which is a national hotline,
yep.
you're probably up all night, you're probably busy as heck, waiting through all the legitimate claims and the hoaxes and the people who are just drunk. How many of the reports do you get, would you say, are of a more legitimate nature, and how many are either hoaxes or just people seeing something else?
Yeah. In rough, round figures, we estimate that only about 10 or 20% of the time that the hotline telephone rings does it have anything to do with a bona fide UFO. When I use that term, let me explain. For me, that term means an anomalous object, a disc, a cigar, or some peculiar object that seems to defy rational explanation that appears to be under intelligent control.
Or if Richard Dreyfuss called in, it'd be an ice cream cone.
Yeah. But only about 10%, roughly, of the calls we take end up being what we consider to be a genuine UFO sighting.
Well, that's scientifically significant when you figure that 3% is usually all you need to determine if a phenomenon is worth looking at.
Yeah.
But that you need more than that if you want to get federal funding.
True.
Yeah. It's going to be a long time before we get federal funding or any kind of government funding.
Now, we got to move on here in a minute because we have some other guests booked tonight, but I want to ask you real quick. We were talking a little while ago about a sighting in April over the Bangor, Maine. There's a nuclear submarine base there.
Bangor, Washington, about 30 miles west of Seattle.
That's what I meant.
Yes.
It's late night.
Yeah.
And they just did some work in the studio, and there's all kind of paint fumes and ether in here or something, I don't know. maybe it's just the effect of talking about UFOs, but
yeah.
We're all getting a little dizzy on this end. Why would a UFO, and I know that there have been other reports over the years of UFOs hovering or being sighted near places where they keep nuclear arms.
Well, there are many people who make that assertion, but from my vantage point, I'm not sure that the data we have would necessarily support the theory that these UFOs are seen over nuclear facilities any more frequently than they're seen over telephone booths, empty garages, golden arches, or anything else. From my observation, and people can see a distribution map of sightings on our website, from my vantage point, one is apt to see a UFO almost anywhere over the United States, and in point of fact, over almost any country of the world.
But would it be accurate, though, when we do have reports of UFOs over military installations, there seems to be at least a more purposeful presence there as opposed to just the incidental sighting over McDonald's? Does that bear out?
Not that I'm aware of. It may. It's just that we have not looked at the data to test that theory. It appears to us that these objects have an interest in many things if their approach to the ground is evidence of their interest in something at a low altitude, for example. But we're not sure that's the case, and I think to answer that question, Terry, which is a good one, we're going to have to talk to the occupants of these craft.
Now, it seems to me that if you have sightings that are around or near military bases, that that could be strong evidence that some of these unidentified flying objects are, in fact, military vehicles that are being test-flown or being checked out to work the bugs out. If you'd seen the stealth bomber in the 50s, you might have thought you were seeing a UFO.
That's true, and that's a good point, except for the fact that it doesn't make an ounce of sense, at least in my opinion, that a super secret craft, as you describe it, would show up over, for example, Phoenix for an hour or 2 hours duration, fly through the airspace of international airports, fly over airliners on the ramp loaded with passengers and fuel, risking life and limb. If this super secret military piece of equipment breaks one bolt and comes down in a heap, then you've killed a lot of people and you've exposed a, let's say, a classified operation. It doesn't make an ounce of sense to me that the military would be flying something like this in the airspace where these objects are seen.
Including the sighting that you're referring to over the Bangor submarine base?
Including that. That object was seen all over the western end of Washington State, in fact. The Bangor submarine base was only roughly 1/500th of the ground, represents only 1/500th of the ground track of the object as it covered western Washington.
Okay, Pete, I don't know, this may not have made it to your website, but back in October of 96, we did have an interesting case that did actually prove to be military flares, which had some similarities to Arizona.
Is this the one in Middletown?
No, no, that's not Middletown.
Okay,
that's
good.
That was
We're
just
not
a terrible
about
hoax.
The one in
no,
Middletown.
Not that's ancient history.
That was a bunch of drunken teenagers, is what that one was.
It sure was.
I think I've heard of this case, actually, Terry.
Yeah.
Well, go ahead and
some very good work in researching it, I think.
Yeah, we worked hard on that, and we ran down as many leads as we could. And it did turn out to be the Ohio Air National Guard doing maneuvers over the, military airspace dedicated to Wright Pat.
Yeah.
But I don't know, you know, beyond that, what the parallels would bear out.
Well, let me address that issue squarely, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
On the 29th of March this year, I was in Scottsdale presenting our evidence over the course of an hour to a fairly sizable audience. I invited six of the actual witnesses with whom we had spoken shortly after their sighting to come and attend the presentation and stand up during my presentation and hold out their arms to show how big the object was above their head as it glided silently over them. Tim Lee, for example, estimated that the object that glided over him, his wife, and his son in a matter of seconds subtended an arc of between 120 and 140 degrees.
That's big.
It was like having a football stadium or something even bigger still hovering directly over him. And it was so close to him, they estimate less than 500 feet above their head, It was so close to them that they could see fine detail on the ventral surface of the craft. And when one of the huge lights on the starboard wing, if we can call it a wing, of this object, passed over his head, directly overhead, they could stare up into that light, and what it appeared to be to them is a recessed cylinder, perhaps 30 feet in diameter, that extended up into the object, with very highly reflective interior surfaces on the inside of that cylinder. That doesn't sound like a military flare to me.
No, it doesn't at all. There has been some video on that, is that correct?
And yes.
Were there any still pictures by any chance?
As far as I know, the only still pictures that I have seen were taken from the videos.
Okay.
With frame grabbers.
Mm-hmm.
But about 12 people captured lights on videotape that night, and only about one or two of them show a distinct V-shaped pattern to them, with all of the lights moving in a coordinated fashion.
Mm-hmm. Now, we'd gotten some sort of mixed information when we were communicating with the folks out in Arizona last summer, and the range of speeds or velocities for this object went from, like, maybe 300 miles an hour to, well, one email said thousands of miles a second, which, of course, that's sort of is kind of hard to see unless it's very far away.
Yeah.
But was there this sort of wide range of speeds reported?
Yes.
Or?
Yes, the object was at several locations above Arizona. It was seen to hover in a motionless fashion. It was just stock still in the night sky. Bear in mind that the object is estimated to have been between 2 and 3 miles in width. That's a very large object to hold still, hovering in the night sky above Arizona. Yet we know that it covered the distance between Henderson, Nevada, very close to Las Vegas, down to Paulden, Utah, about 60 or 80 miles north of Phoenix, in less than 22 minutes. So it was capable of flying at supersonic speeds.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty good for an object that is 2 to 3 miles in width. So our listeners can imagine what we're talking about, next time they take off from a major international airport, imagine an object, a craft, the wingspan of which is longer than the runway that their jet takes off on. And we had many, many people report to us that their impression of the object that they had just witnessed seconds or minutes earlier was big enough for a 747 jetliner to land on the top of. That's how big it was.
That's a lot of inertia to overcome, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes.
And it was able to accelerate faster than the human eye was able to follow it. So we're clearly dealing with a technology that is so vastly beyond ours that it's even difficult for seasoned UFO investigators to imagine what it is we're dealing with.
Peter Davenport, thank you for taking the time to talk to UFO Update on the Chris and Rob Show tonight.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure, and I've enjoyed it thoroughly. It's very nice to meet Terry.
Well, you've got a lot to say. We'll have you on again sometime.
That sounds fine.
And before we let you go, I want to give you another opportunity if you'd like to either give out your website or the phone number if someone has recently seen an unidentified flying object or just something that they can't explain if they would like to call your hotline.
With pleasure. If they'd like to look at our data, and we try to post our data publicly as fast as we can, the website address is www.ufocenter.com, and they can submit written reports from that website. Our telephone number in Seattle, the National UFO Reporting Center hotline, is area code 206-722-3000.
Thank you, Peter Davenport.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You bet.
Thanks.
Thanks. Good night, Terry.
Good night.
The National UFO Reporting Center. We've got more in store for you tonight. This is the Chris and Rob Late Night Talk Show bringing you UFO Update. And Terry Andrus, you used to have a hand in the cable access program UFO Update.
That's correct, yes.
And you brought to the Cincinnati and Tri-State Public the latest information that was available regarding some of these unusual things.
Yes, we made that effort.
You still, besides the Anomaly Research Center, you're still involved with the Center for UFO Studies.
That's correct. I'm an associate member, and right now I am working on some projects for them.
What kind of projects, besides coming out to these late-night talk shows and stealing all our beer?
Well, we are kind of looking into these Arizona sightings to see just exactly what we can piece together.
But do you think sightings in Arizona have any impact on Cincinnati, Ohio?
Well, not necessarily, but the article is also going to include our research on the sightings out there in Adams County that I referred to when I was speaking to Mr. Davenport. So we're going to try to put the two things together and see what we can come up with.
Space shuttle, which one? Was it Columbia or Atlantis? I don't know. One of the space shuttles was launched the other day. And right now it should be docking with the space station Mir, orbiting somewhere above the planet Earth at this time. And WAIF is proud to bring you a live link-up with the Mir space station. We've got our engineers out in the hallway right now, banging and clattering on some of the transistors and some of the transmitters and transistors and everything out there. It's all technical jargon. I won't bore you with it. But as soon as some of our engineers out there finish twiddling with a few knobs, I think we can bring you a live link-up with the Mir space station. Mr. Michael Wood.
This is Mike Wood, and as the chairman of Stepchild Radio, I'm immensely proud to announce the first hot live link-up between the Mir space station and WAIF here in Cincinnati, Ohio.
I am Boris Luzmagarajki, the commander of the Mir space station.
And I am Vladimir Slapyodikalot, the co-pilot of the Mir space station. And I know where the vodka is stowed away on board.
Well, looky here, Vladimir. The space station Columbia is coming this way. Must be those crazy Americans with their crazy powdered ice cream.
Yeah, Boris, I hate that stuff. But we can always trade powdered loaf of bread for some.
Well, greetings, fellow explorers in space. My name is Buck Rogers, and I am an American astronaut from Earth, here to perform daring deeds of courage to save humanity from the plummeting Mir space station.
Good to meet you, comrade. Do you have the new issue of American Thighs Monthly on ya?
Yeah, and some of that powdered meatloaf. I love that stuff.
Mayday, mayday. Orbiting satellite containing radioactive fecal debris on collision course with the Mir space station. Take evasive action immediately. Mayday, mayday.
How did a flying can of poop get out here in the middle of outer space?
That's what I came here to warn you about, gentlemen. Project SETI has finally detected an alien life form, and apparently E.T. has discovered a leftover packet of powdered beef stroganoff from one of the Apollo missions.
Damn that dinty more. What should we do now, heroic American?
Fire thrusters and let's get out of the way.
We cannot do that, heroic American. The thrusters are in the shop being worked on. Everything on Space Station Mir is broken. We won't have thrusters back until Turd's Day, after 5. But back before Friends comes on, no?
I know what we can do. Here, proud American, eat up this powdered Olesta fat-free substitute. This stuff will go right through ya.
Hey, this powdered Olesta fat-free substitute is pretty damn tasty. Hey, got any powdered ketchup?
Now what do we do, Commander?
When the greasy Americans start to fart, open the pod bay doors. The force of the Americans' flatulence will propel us out of the way of the evil flying turd.
Slava Bogul! That is Russian for hippie beret. We are saved from the orbiting brown log of doom.
Slava Bogul, let's break out the vodka.
Always glad to be of assistance, my cosmic friends. I must now return to Venice, California, to rescue mankind from the burrito of terror. Good luck, my little red friends.
Thank you, heroic American. You have saved the day.
That seemed to last about 8 minutes.
Hello, Mason. You still with us?
Yeah.
We're back at WAIF, the UFO update, brought to you by the Chris and Rob Late Night Talk Show and WAIF, Stepchild Radio. If you have any questions or comments regarding UFOs, alien abductions, crop circles, or cattle mutilations, you can call us at 961-8900. And in a minute, we're going to be talking to a fellow about alien abductions and about the threat that they pose to the world at large. I'm joined tonight by Terry Endress, and Terry is with the Anomaly Research Center. What exactly is the Anomaly Research Center? And if somebody wants to get in contact with it, how do they do that?
Well, the Anomaly Research Center, again, is just a sort of loosely coordinated group of investigators who want to bring some common sense to this field. Far too many folks are jumping to conclusions, and we would rather err on the side of caution. If you want to visit the website, it's at http://home.fuse.net/arcsite. That's ARCSITE/.
And ARC stands for Anomaly Research Center.
Correct.
And an anomaly is not something that grows on the side of a boat in Lake Erie.
That's correct.
Next, we're joined by Dr. David Jacobs, author of The Threat. A threat to whom? Dr. Jacobs?
Yeah.
Yeah. A threat to whom?
Well, I think that the UFO phenomenon is certainly a threat to all of our concepts of what this phenomenon is all about, and maybe even a threat to all of us personally.
You, besides being the author of the book, The Threat, David Jacobs, you are a longtime, would you be a researcher in the field of alien abductions?
Well, I've spent my entire adult life, that's since about 1965, 66, researching the UFO and abduction phenomenon. I've written three books on the subject, and I teach the only regularly scheduled university course on the subject, which I've done for the past 20 years. And so I guess that you could call me that, although actually I'm a professor of history at Temple University in Philadelphia.
You've interviewed a bunch of people. I mean, when I say interviewed, I mean interviewed extensively. A bunch of people who have been abducted by UFOs, have you not?
I have. I've had hypnotic sessions with about 125 individuals. And, of course, I've interviewed just orally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds more over the years.
Do you believe that alien abductions are something that actually take place and are not just a psychological phenomena?
I think the evidence is fairly overwhelming that the abductions actually do take place. They're not internally generated. That is to say, people are not dreaming them up for whatever reason. And they take place in real time to real people, so to speak.
Well, I never suggested that anyone was dreaming them up, but certainly individuals could have traumatic experiences in their life. You know, people who are abused as children sometimes wind up with multiple personalities,
right,
or something like that. And could there not be some sort of explanation for people who feel that they've been abducted?
Right. Of course, all we did for the first 20 years of knowing of this subject was look at psychological explanations for this phenomenon. It's the first thing we looked at, of course, and it's the only thing we've looked at. And we really don't think that this kind of a phenomenon fits the psychological models that we've seen. The psychological models just don't seem to fit. In other words, people see other people being abducted or may not be abducted themselves. People are physically missing from their normal environments when they say they're abducted. We don't have a single case where people have been seen hiding out somewhere at a corner bar or something like that, you know, seen by others. And people present all sorts of other kind of evidence in support of their contentions, unusual scars on their body, which literally were not there the day before, and stains on their clothes, or all sorts of other things. So the key thing here is that everybody basically says the same thing, regardless of where they're from, regardless of their ethnic group or their religion or their level of education or technological level or place where they live. They all say the same thing, and they say it in really quite precise detail. It's just sort of extraordinary, and we don't have any psychological models that can fit something like that with that kind of detail and quality of story.
No, but all psychological models aside, there is some continuity to all the different stories from people who have never met each other before and people who haven't seen all the same science fiction movies.
That's exactly right. It doesn't really matter where people are from. In other words, I have abductees come from tribal societies. They come from the island of Manhattan. They come from Kansas. They come from absolutely everywhere. And they all say the same thing. It doesn't have anything to do with their own lives, which is quite bizarre. If it were psychological, every story would have something to do with their own lives. Every one.
So
but
if
in fact, we don't see that.
So if more than one person who have never been in contact and who all have not seen the day the Earth stood still are all reporting the same thing, the same types of creatures and the same procedures, then other than the postulation that alien abductions are real, how could they be explained?
Right. Well, other than that, we're just lost. We just can't explain it. If these are not happening, then abduction researchers have stumbled onto one of the most important psychological phenomena that we have ever encountered. Because if these are not happening and people are seeing other people being abducted, and it's not happening and they're all remembering the same thing, then we have to sort of revise everything we know about psychiatry and cognition and mentality and how the brain is organized and what people are born with. And they wouldn't be born with a clean slate where they just learn things and sort of put it on the brain. They would be hardwired with these kinds of precise stories, and it would only be about one thing, and that is being abducted by aliens. It wouldn't be about anything else. If this isn't happening, we are into a very strange world indeed.
Dr. Jacobs, I want to get into some of these stories of some of the people that you've talked to about abductions, and I also want to talk to you about what this threat is that threatens mankind. But first, I'd like to introduce to you our in-studio guest tonight, Terry Endress. He's with the Anomaly Research Center here in Cincinnati.
Hi, how are you doing?
Hi, Terry.
Listen, since your research is engaged in using regressive hypnosis, what kind of qualifications do you need, or certification, whatever it is, in order to do this ethically?
Well, that is an excellent question, and thank you for asking that. And one of the great problems that we have in UFO abduction research today is the problem of everybody and his parakeets can do hypnosis. It's like a huge fad that's going around, and everybody is doing abduction, regression, hypnosis, and the potential for abuse is there, believe me, and harm can be caused, and we have to be very, very careful.
You point out in your book that you have to be careful about that very thing, even when it comes to trying to figure out who has and who has not a legitimate claim to make about an abduction. Isn't that correct?
Absolutely, absolutely. And right now there is no certification in abduction hypnosis, unfortunately. And of course, anybody can learn hypnosis. In California, all you have to do is just sort of plunk down your money and you go to a storefront. Literally, this is literally true. And you can become a certified hypnotherapist by taking their little course. And thousands of people in California have done it, and they're all certified by the state. Some people are extremely good, and other ones are just awful. But none of this qualifies. Even the best hypnotists are not qualified to do abduction hypnosis because they don't know anything about the problems engendered in this, and they don't know anything about the abduction phenomenon. They don't know what questions to ask, and they don't know how to evaluate the answers. And this has been a huge problem because people will confabulate. People will say things that are not true. Memory is faulty. And for the average hypnotist, whether it's a psychiatrist, a psychologist, or just a certified hypnotherapist in a sense, when they hear things that abductees say, they tend to take everything at face value. And this has led many people into the never-never land and has led them astray. And it really has muddied the waters considerably. It's a serious problem.
Hypnosis is a bit of a controversial procedure as far as being taken seriously by the rest of the scientific community.
Absolutely. Hypnosis itself is one of the problems with hypnosis is that we don't exactly know how it works, and we don't We don't exactly know what happens in the brain during the hypnotic state.
What do you do personally to sift out the good cases, say, from the bad? How do you make that determination?
Well, before I actually see a person, before a person presents him or herself to me in my office, I usually spend a considerable amount of time with them on the phone. When they contact me, the very first thing I do is send them a questionnaire, or I'll ask them all the questions on the phone. They then talk with me for about an hour about the answers to their questions. I talk about their lives and this, that, and the other thing, and I give them a very, very strong warning about doing this, about the dangers of going forward with hypnosis, that if I think that it's warranted even. And some people call me up and they tell me what's happened to them, and it's clear to me that this doesn't sound like abduction stuff to me. But if there is something that's suggestive, I try to warn them away from doing hypnosis. I try to tell them that if they find out anything is going on, it could be a life-changing situation, and, you know, are they really ready to do that? And I get maybe 33% of the people call me to drop out right then and there just by scaring them, which is the right thing to do, because they got to be forewarned and forearmed. And then I send them a pamphlet to read, which discusses the pros and cons of finding out, and it hits fairly heavily on the cons. And I have them talk about it with their husbands or wives or whoever, and then they have to call me back again, and I give them another warning and so forth. And so by the time they get to me, they've already been through a sort of sifting process.
So you try your best to dissuade them, in other words.
I try my best to dissuade them. And even after all my warnings and all my threats and admonitions and all the rest of that stuff, perhaps 25% of them will only do one session with me, and then it just scares them too much and they don't come back. And, of course, that's the right decision for them. My basic precept is, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. If a person is leading a normal life, if everything is okay, then there's no sense in looking into the Pandora's box. You never know what's going to come out. And you know, if you're leading a happy life, well, why screw that up?
The phone lines are open at the UFO Update with Terry Endress, and I'm Chris Comer. We're talking to Dr. David Jacobs of Temple University about alien abduction and cases that he studied. If you'd like to call in, the lines are open at 961-8900. You don't mind taking a call or two if we actually get one, do you?
Absolutely, it's fine.
961-8900. Dr. Jacobs, you've spent a lot of your time interviewing people who've been abducted by UFOs or aliens or whatever. Tell us a little bit about some of the case stories, some of the case histories of some of these stories, and the things that are in common with them.
Well, basically what people say when they say they've been abducted is they say that they're taken out of their normal environments by these beings, and usually against their will, and they are taken on board an object, their clothes are removed, they're placed on a table, they're given a series of physical, mental, and reproductive procedures, essentially. They are sometimes have to hold odd-looking babies, which they say look sort of like crosses between humans and aliens, hybrids, if you will. They sometimes see these hybrid babies, as toddlers, as children, as sort of older youth, as adolescents, and as adults as well. They have various other procedures. Their clothes are put back on. They're brought back to their normal environment. And within seconds, they forget what has happened to them, although they know something strange has just transpired. They might have been in a car, and it's 2 hours later, and they're still in the same spot, and they can't understand how that happened. They've just been driving along, and it's 4 o'clock instead of 2 o'clock, and they're no further than they were before. So they know something odd happened, but oftentimes it's difficult for them to place it within the UFO context.
Let's step back a few feet here, and you mentioned hybrids. How does that work genetically? Are we talking about extraterrestrials at this point, or what are we talking about as far as identifying the abductors?
Right, well, you know, from the very beginning of the abduction phenomenon, in fact, from the very first cases we heard of the Barney and Betty Hill case and the Antonio Vias Boas case in Brazil, both of these had a reproductive component. And this reproductive component, and I'm not necessarily saying a sexual component, but a reproductive component, has been in existence in virtually all of the abduction accounts that we hear. It's extremely common.
Well, but the problem I'm having with it is genetically, how is it possible? I mean, we can't cross with, say, a zebra or something, you know, exotically different than we are.
Look, the chimpanzee has something like 98% of the same chromosomes that we do, same genetic background, and we cannot reproduce with a chimpanzee.
Correct.
And believe me, I've tried and tried and tried. It just doesn't work.
Oh, my God, you can't be serious. You have not tried to breed with a chimpanzee.
Well, not in the last couple of days, anyway.
No, I mean, if you take a horse and a donkey, you get a mule, but if you take a human and an alien, what are you going to get?
Well, what we see here is something that the only thing we can do is sort of figure out. We can try to extrapolate what's happening here based on testimony. Obviously, there are sort of educated guesses.
Well, my guess would be that it may not necessarily be any kind of a crossbreeding. I mean, that doesn't make sense genetically. But would it be possible maybe that they are extracting genetic material to genetically engineer? Not necessarily mixed with their own, but to alter our genetic structure so that we, in a sense, start to take on their traits. Is that a possibility?
It certainly is possible, absolutely. What people report, however, just to sort of stick with their testimony, is they say sperm is routinely taken, and women report that eggs are taken on a routine basis, and then they say that they're women say that they're implanted with an embryo with a zygote, if you will, and when the zygote or the embryo is removed after, let's just say, 10 weeks, and this is a commonly reported phenomenon, the removal of whatever fetus was there, they say that the fetus begins to take the shape. It looks sort of human and sort of not human, and the aliens will indicate to the woman that this one is hers, that this is part of her, that she's in this. And they will say that to the man as well. So they themselves will make the connection that the genetic material is there. Now the question is then, if there's a fertilized egg with human sperm and egg, how do you get this odd-looking creature, so to speak, out of this? And it might be the introduction of alien DNA in some way that we, in a technological way that we're not familiar with. It might be an alteration in some way of whatever is already there. But in a way, we really don't know the technicalities of it. The best thing we can say is that this is so common, we recognize it as a very, very important part of the phenomenon, and almost everybody will describe it eventually. And we think that that in some way they are producing these odd-looking hybrids.
And what is the threat behind all this?
Well, I think that all UFO researchers have been chasing a sort of two holy grails. The first holy grail is it real, is it not real? Are they here, are they not here? Is this a real extraterrestrial phenomenon? And I think for most UFO researchers who are into this on a very serious level, that question has been answered. This is an extraterrestrial phenomenon. And then there's only one other question. And the other question is, well, just what do they want? What are they doing here? What is the purpose here? What are the motivations behind their being here?
Well, do you think that when humans evolve past the stage of sending Viking-type orbiters to the other planets, that someday we might actually go to a planet and not only take soil samples, but if we find something alive, we might take it aboard our ship and study it and probe it and stick needles in it to find out how it works?
Right. Well, that's certainly true, and that's sort of the way we thought for many years, and that's what I call the experiment model, or the study model. Actually, though, the evidence doesn't seem to indicate that. The evidence seems to indicate more of a program, a physiological program of the exploitation of one species by another species. We really don't have evidence for a long-term experiment or a long-term study, which almost every researcher originally thought. But the evidence for that just isn't there. What we see here is a program primarily of producing these hybrids that goes on, has been going on for quite a while, and I think that the threat ultimately is that my own research, and obviously people can do their own research and maybe come up with different conclusions, and in fact, I hope I'm wrong.